Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, December 1st, 2025. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Washington Attorney General Nick Brown sues Trump Housing and Urban Development Department for switching away from Housing First model to a temporary shelter model. Sandpoint repeals human rights ordinance protecting gay and trans people. And Washington resident first to die from rare bird flu strain. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The person U.S. law enforcement say shot two National Guard members on patrol in Washington, D.C. Wednesday has ties to Bellingham, Washington. The suspect is 29-year-old Ramandullah Lakhanwal, who is an Afghan who was living in Bellingham with his wife and five children. U.S. law enforcement say he shot and killed West Virginia National Guard member Sarah Beckstrom and shot and wounded 24-year-old Andrew Wolf, another West Virginia National Guard member. Wolf is reportedly in critical condition. Lakhanwal was also seriously wounded during the attack and remains hospitalized. U.S. law enforcement says he appears to have acted alone. FBI Director Kash Patel said his agency is executing search warrants around the country, including at Lakhanwal's Bellingham address. According to the Seattle Times, the CIA has said Lakhanwal was a member of a unit that the agency backed in Afghanistan. Lakhanwal came to the U.S. as part of Operation Allies Welcome, in which Afghans who helped U.S. troops and were fleeing the Taliban could come to the U.S. and apply for asylum. CNN reported the U.S. government formally granted Lakhanwal asylum in April of this year. In response to the shooting, Trump has ordered the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services to halt all processing of immigration requests from Afghan nationals. The Seattle Times reports Afghan community leaders in Washington say they condemn the actions of the shooter, but say their community should not be punished for the actions of one person. There currently are about 100,000 Afghan refugees living in the United States who left Afghanistan during the withdrawal of U.S. troops in 2021. The Military Times reports there are an estimated 150,000 Afghans who helped U.S. troops during the war who are still in Afghanistan. Bellingham Mayor Kim Lund wrote in a statement Thursday, "We share the resolve to see justice and accountability for this violent attack. The terrible actions committed in Washington, D.C. yesterday are the actions of one person, not a community. They don't represent Bellingham's values. They don't reflect the values of either Washington. They don't represent what makes our communities great."
Federal tax credits for making energy-saving changes at home are expiring at the end of the year, but some opportunities for Oregonians to save on upgrades will remain beyond 2025. Expiring federal energy efficiency credits can save homeowners up to $3,200 on upgrades like heat pumps and insulation. Originally established to last 10 years under the Inflation Reduction Act, these and other climate incentives are ending under H.R. 1. But Jamie Seymour with Energy Trust of Oregon says its cash incentives and programs will continue regardless of federal changes.
For people who have made these upgrades this year, they can receive both the tax credit and that incentive, really stacking those savings and taking advantage of that opportunity before the end of the year.
Seymour explains energy trust incentives can be received as instant savings at retailers, as an upfront deduction through a vetted contractor, or as cash back after completing an upgrade. She adds upgrades like heat pumps, high-efficiency gas furnaces, and solar panels are eligible for both the expiring federal credits and ongoing energy trust incentives. Electric costs in Oregon have increased significantly, with residential rates for Pacific Power and PGE rising increasing by about 50% since 2020. Seymour says insulation is one of the easiest, most cost-effective ways to lower energy use and make your home more comfortable year-round. And she says until the end of the year, it still qualifies for federal tax credits.
And adding insulation around your home can lower your heating costs by up to 20%. So that makes a really big difference when keeping your home warm during the winter.
Seymour says the federal tax credit for insulation is up to $1,200. And in addition, Energy Trust lowers the cost by $1.50 per square foot and more for families with lower incomes. She adds people can visit energytrust.org to find a vetted contractor who can do an energy assessment to see what upgrades to their home would make the most impact. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Washington Attorney General Nick Brown is leading a multi-state lawsuit against the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development for illegally placing conditions on their Continuum of Care grant program and shifting away from the housing first approach to homelessness, which has proved effective, and shifting towards programs that provide transitional housing with work requirements and other conditions. Housing First programs work toward putting people in permanent housing without conditions rather than transitional housing. The spokesman review reports Attorney General Brown's office says 90% of the HUD program money administered by the state goes to support permanent housing. But under the new housing and urban development rules, only 30% would go towards that. Washington typically receives $120 million per year under the HUD Continuum of Care program. Congress allocated $3.9 billion for the program for 2026. The multi-state lawsuit, which was filed in Rhode Island Tuesday, says the new conditions require housing providers only recognize two genders of humans, which defies scientific evidence. The lawsuit also says the new conditions prioritize jurisdictions that prohibit public illicit drug use and public camping and loitering. Brown said during a news conference last week, in violation of congressional intent and the department's own intentions, HUD is drastically reducing the amount of grant funds that can be used for permanent supportive housing. HUD is also arbitrarily nixing providers' eligibility, not based on their expertise or professionalism, but whether or not they serve jurisdictions that essentially criminalize being unhoused. Brown's office also said the changes will create administrative chaos with thousands of residents likely losing their housing, therefore increasing homelessness. The lawsuit says instead of investing in programs that help people stay safe and housed, the Trump administration has embraced policies that risk trapping people in poverty and punishing them for being poor. Washington Governor Bob Ferguson issued a statement Tuesday which said, "This $120 million in annual funding supports data-driven programs that are proven to help stabilize people so they can have the best chance to secure permanent housing." Trump is once more playing politics with people's most basic needs. Washington Commerce Department Director Joe Nguyen said there may be a gap in services if providers cannot work through the process by December 15th. Nguyen said they may not be able to fund some of the work they are currently doing. He said because HUD delayed the announcement of the new conditions, it will be, quote, almost impossible for the funds to be administered. Attorney General Brown said it is Washington's 45th lawsuit against the second Trump administration. He said, "The tie that binds all of these cases together is Washington State's resilience in the face of unconstitutional or illegal actions to protect the best interests of our state and the people of our state. And we will continue to do that every day and fight and challenge those unlawful actions." The Sandpoint City Council voted November 19th to repeal their ordinance barring discrimination in employment, housing, and public accommodations. After hours of heated testimony and debate, and a council tie vote, Mayor Jeremy Grimm cast the tie-breaking vote to take away Sandpoint residents' and visitors' right to be free of discrimination due to sexual orientation or gender identity or expression. The 2011 ordinance states everyone in the city can enjoy the full benefits of citizenship. The new ordinance removes that language and says, with this amendment, the city of Sandpoint seeks to align its non-discrimination provisions with existing federal and state civil rights law. The new amendment also says its intent is to, quote, clarify that the city does not establish or enforce independent local definitions, protected classes, or complaint investigation procedures beyond those set forth, unquote, by Congress, the courts, or the Idaho legislature. The Sandpoint Reader reported a YMCA lifeguard posted on Facebook in October. She had seen, quote, a man semi-dressed as a woman using the YMCA's women's locker room, and that the lifeguard was told by the YMCA and the Sandpoint police this was legal because the city anti-discrimination ordinance allows people to use locker rooms that align with their gender identity. The Facebook post spurred a debate about whether women who use changing spaces like locker rooms were endangered. During the city council debate, Mayor Grimm said the issues are, quote, complex civil rights questions that, in my opinion, belong to the state or federal government. According to the Idaho Statesman, city council member Kyle Schreiber, who voted against repealing the ordinance, said while he takes concerns about protecting women from sexual harassment or assault seriously, the focus on transgender individuals' use of a locker room is misplaced. Schreiber said, it seems like every other day there's another article in our local paper about a sexual predator. Here's the thing, though. None of those incidents involved a man dressed as a woman in order to gain access to his victims. I couldn't find a single one. After the vote, Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates Idaho Director Misty Delicarpini-Tolman said in a news release, the fears about locker room use are manufactured. Delicarpini-Tolman said, the city council was persuaded by fear and misinformation. Sandpoint is now a bellwether for how quickly established rights can be undone when misinformation and political pressure go unchecked. In 2011, Sandpoint was the first of 13 Idaho cities to vote to ban discrimination against gay and transgender people in employment, housing, and public accommodations. According to Planned Parenthood Alliance advocates, Sandpoint last month became the first of the 13 Idaho cities to dial back or repeal their ordinances. Idahoans United for Women and Families say they used Small Business Saturday after Thanksgiving to host their largest signature gathering event so far to reach the 71,000 signature threshold needed to get their initiative on the 2026 ballot, repealing Idaho's anti-abortion laws that prohibit all abortions from conception unless doctors determine the life of the pregnant person is in danger. The group announced last week they had already reached the 50,000 signature threshold. In a statement, Idahoans United for Women and Families Executive Director Melanie Falwell said, crossing the 50,000 signature threshold is both a celebration and a clear signal that Idahoans want their voices heard. Every signature is a reminder that these decisions belong with patients and their doctors, not with politicians. Falwell said the initiative would, quote, establish a right to make private reproductive health care decisions, including abortion, up to fetal viability and in medical emergencies. After the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022, which made abortion policy into a state-by-state issue, Idaho's current felony abortion law came into effect. It's called the Gem State Defense of Life Act. Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled Idaho's abortion law does not prevent doctors from performing abortions in emergency situations in order to save the life of a mother, nor does it impede or obstruct miscarriage care. According to a study from Boise State University researchers, Idaho's law caused the loss of about 35% of the state's practicing obstetricians between 2022 and 2024, totaling 94 of the 268 OBGYNs in Idaho. During the study, 20 new obstetricians moved into the state, while 114 left their practices or moved out of state. Susan B. Anthony, Pro-Life America State Affairs Director Kelsey Pritchard, said in order for the anti-abortion movement to succeed, they must learn from the 2024 playbook. Pritchard said the pro-life states that have defeated pro-abortion ballot measures provide the roadmap for Idaho. Pro-life leaders in Idaho must build an effective coalition as Florida, South Dakota, and Nebraska did early on that can raise enough money to run a winning campaign. Washington Health Department officials report an older state resident is believed to be the first person to die from a rare strain of bird flu. The agency said the Grays Harbor County resident had underlying health conditions and had been undergoing treatment for that strain of bird flu, known as H5N5. According to the Centers for Disease Control newsroom, a Louisiana hospital patient died in January from another strain of avian bird flu called H5N1. The newsroom called the death, quote, the first case of H5N1 bird flu in the U.S. that has been linked to exposure to a backyard flock. State public health veterinarian Dr. Beth Lipton said in a news briefing, wild birds migrate in the fall and winter and can carry the virus to commercial poultry farms and backyard flocks. Last year, Washington health officials said there were 14 confirmed and probable cases of bird flu in humans in the state, and all of those people were in direct contact with dead or sick poultry at a commercial farm. According to the Associated Press, Washington health officials say the difference between H5N5 and H5N1 strains is a protein involved in how it releases a virus from an infected cell and promoting the spread to surrounding cells. Grays Harbor County is about 78 miles southwest of Seattle. The resident who died had a backyard flock of domestic poultry, which was exposed to H5N5 from wild birds. In a statement, the Washington health official said the risk to the public remains low. No other people involved have tested positive for avian influenza. The Centers for Disease Control said there is pertinent information to suggest the risk to public health has increased as a result of this case. CDC officials say the H5N5 virus is not believed to be a larger threat to people's health than the H5N1 virus, despite a wave of infections. Most of the 70 illnesses in 2024 and this year affected workers on dairy and poultry farms. Health officials say most of the cases were mild. Canada Prime Minister Mark Carney signed an agreement Thursday that will enable the construction of a major new oil pipeline between the Alberta tar sands and the British Columbia coast. Carney says expanding oil exports to Asian markets is a response to Trump tariff and trade policies. He said the new energy policy will cut down on Canada's dependence on the United States when it comes to trade. The new agreement lifts the federal cap on emissions from Alberta's massive oil and gas sector and would exempt the province from federal rules that phase out the use of fossil fuels for electricity generation. It also postpones a deadline for reducing methane leaks into the atmosphere. Critics say the new agreement swings Canada away from measures which fight climate change. The agreement is likely to face pushback from First Nations Indigenous groups and the province of British Columbia. While the agreement does not specify a route for the pipeline, the New York Times indicates the federal government is willing to end its ban on oil tankers off the northern coast of British Columbia. That rugged coastline has frequent storms. The ban came in 2019 after a proposed oil pipeline from Alberta to northern British Columbia caused concern about the possibility of oil spills. The coastal First Nations group, the Haida Nation in British Columbia, is likely to resist any new pipeline proposal. Haida Nation Council President Gagwis Jason Alsop said, "There is no support, there is no project, there's no interest in being part of any oil pipeline. It's a non-starter." The Moscow City Council tonight will hear the final results of a random survey city staff is doing in order to show more than 51% of city residents are middle or lower income in order to qualify for Idaho Community Development Block grants for projects impacting the entire city. The council will also vote on an agreement that would allow New St. Andrews College access across unimproved city property adjacent to their college building at 112 North Main Street. The access easement would allow New St. Andrews to improve a non-conforming parking lot that has historically served tenants of the building. The Moscow Council will also vote on approving a $2,500 grant request to the Idaho A250 Celebration Fund for themed celebrations for the nation's 250th anniversary, particularly around July 4th, 2026. The council will also vote on accepting the canvassed election results from Latah County. The council will also hear a Citizen Commission report from the Historic Preservation Commission from Commission Chair Nels Reese. The Moscow City Council will meet tonight at 7 p.m. at City Hall.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and Rembrandt Tree Care, family owned and operated since 1977. A conscientious approach to urban forestry with year-round tree service on the Palouse and surrounding areas. You can reach Rembrandt Tree Care at 509-330-0699.
KRFP thanks all of its donors and underwriters for helping make this programming possible.
A coalition of 40 school districts and other K-12 education organizations has written to Washington Governor Bob Ferguson and members of the legislature, telling them to fix the unintended consequences of the state's new retail sales tax on digital advertising, information technology, security, temporary staffing, and live presentations. Lawmakers pushed the bill late in this year's legislative session as a way to raise $1.1 billion in revenue for the state through 2027. School districts and education institutions assumed they would be exempt, in part because some of the new revenue was intended to pay for education. The new retail sales tax went into effect October 1st. By the time lawmakers passed the bill in April, most school districts had already set their budgets for the next school year, and the budgets did not take into account the average 10% sales tax on services. The new tax would add millions of dollars in expenses to some school districts statewide. The Washington State School Directors Association, the Washington State Parent Teachers Association, Seattle Public Schools, and Meade School District in Spokane signed the letter to Governor Ferguson and Washington lawmakers. The letter says, by taxing the very services that schools are legally required to provide, the law has produced the opposite effect, as districts are forced to scale back or redirect limited funds to cover these added taxes. Educators lose access to high-quality, real-time learning that directly strengthens classroom practice. Democratic Representative April Berg of Mill Creek, who is the Washington House Finance Committee chair, said the State Department of Revenue is working on a bill to clarify the new retail sales tax. According to the Seattle Times, a spokesperson for the Revenue Department said they are working on a bill that would make technical corrections, but, quote, would not make substantial or policy changes to the law. Democratic Senate Majority Leader Jamie Peterson of Seattle said one possibility would be to fully exempt school districts from the tax, but the trade-off would be reduced revenue for the state. Democratic Senator Noel Frame of Seattle, who was the main sponsor of the new retail sales tax bill in the legislature this year, said all modifications will be considered carefully and weighed against what programs will have to be cut as a consequence of changes that result in revenue loss. Senate Republican leader John Braun of Centralia said he wants the law repealed, but admitted that's unlikely given the state's projected revenue shortfall.
This Tuesday is Giving Tuesday, when people are encouraged to support their local nonprofits. That support is especially important in states like Idaho. Giving Tuesday caps the holiday shopping days that happen after Thanksgiving, Black Friday, and Cyber Monday. It's meant as a way for people to donate after spending on gifts for the winter holidays. Kevin Bailey is Vice President of Impact in the Idaho Nonprofit Center with the Idaho Community Foundation. He says donations to nonprofits are important in Idaho, which is a small government state that spends less on public services and relies on nonprofits to fill the gap.
In order to maintain that quality of life in Idaho, we need folks to step up and support nonprofits because we certainly don't have a lot of support from public sources. So it's going to have to come from individuals, corporate partners, foundations.
Bailey notes that nonprofits rely on Giving Tuesday to shore up their finances before the end of the year. Bailey says demand for nonprofit services such as Meals on Wheels is going up as more people move to Idaho, despite the lack of resources for these organizations. He calls the current moment a crisis as federal government funding for many services are cut.
It's a really uncertain time for nonprofits, and they're planning budget reductions from those revenue sources. And so the only way to make those up in the short term is to ask the public, private individuals, basically, to give more.
Giving Tuesday was started in 2012 and has increasingly grown in popularity since then. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
New research reveals how successful small grassroots organizations working on climate change in the Northwest can be when barriers to accessing funding are removed. From 2021 to 2025, the Northwest Climate Resilience Collaborative funded local organizations led by those most exposed to climate risks like wildfires and drought, enabling them to implement protective and adaptive measures locally. Zach Thill is with the Climate Impact Group, which ran the collaborative. He says if big funders like universities and philanthropic organizations want results, the research shows they should let frontline communities be in the driver's seat.
We tried to let organizations be their authentic selves so that they could take the funding and do the critical work that they see needs to be done in their communities. Because at the end of the day, they know better than we do of what their community needs.
By removing barriers like narrow definitions of climate resilience, requiring partnerships, and complex reporting, Phil says the Northwest Climate Resilience Collaborative was able to create a competitive application process that was still accessible to small, low-capacity groups. The NCRC was terminated by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration earlier this year. Although its run was short-lived, the NCRC worked with many rural and tribal communities across the Pacific Northwest. It funded a queer and trans organization that conducted research on how extreme heat, wildfire smoke, and drought affects their communities in Washington. The group is now using that research to advocate for change with lawmakers. Another project in rural Oregon tackled nitrate pollution by providing owners of contaminated wells with drinking water, test kits, and education.
This funding unlocked all these different ways that the organization was able to interface better with their community, but also engage with relevant agencies and stakeholders that do a lot of the decision making on these issues.
After completing projects, Phil says he was surprised that groups came back to the NCRC with more ideas for collaboration beyond funding. He says this was a result of taking the time to build trust.
That might be just sitting down, listening to them and trying to understand what their needs are and providing that to them before you start saying things like, let's start a project together.
For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
A Montana military veteran is disappointed he never received his retirement benefits during the government shutdown. Billings veteran Daniel Struckman says he got a notification via email at the end of October that he wouldn't be receiving any money. He served during the Vietnam War and retired as a commissioned officer after 17 years as a medical clinic pharmacist for the U.S. Public Health Service. He says this hasn't happened before.
It really surprised me. It's just unprecedented. I thought I was immune from such things.
Struckman and about 7,500 other Public Health Service veterans found themselves in the same situation. The lapse also affected about 500 military retirees from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It's largely due to the length of the shutdown and a funding oversight. These two groups get their pensions from appropriated funds each year, rather than from the Military Retirement Fund, which pays for all other branches of the military. Congress allocates money for that fund in advance, so most retired veterans got their benefits during the shutdown. Jennifer Goodale with the Military Officers Association of America says this problem used to affect the Coast Guard, but legislation added that branch to the Military Retirement Fund in 2021. She believes it's a problem Congress needs to solve for other uniformed services.
They're the ones that have flown into hurricanes and fought for us during the pandemic and gone wherever the government told them to. And they served their 20 years and earned their pension. And it just hasn't gotten fixed because it's such a small population.
Struckman says while his payments have resumed since the government reopened, he had to dip into his savings to pay the bills. He feels for others who may not have had backup funds available. Goodale says her organization is working with affected organizations, congressional committees, and appropriators to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Even if it affected two people, we would continue to make sure it was fixed because our whole mission is to protect service earned benefits. And that applies to anyone that wore the cloth of our nation, and that's all uniformed service members.
I'm Laura Hatch, Big Sky Connection.
Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area. 60% chance of snow tonight, mainly after 4 a.m. Patchy fog after midnight, patchy freezing fog after 3 a.m. Nighttime snow accumulation, less than half an inch possible. Otherwise, cloudy, low 29. 60% chance of snow tomorrow, mainly before 7 a.m. Patchy freezing fog before 7 a.m. Cloudy, high 36. New snow accumulation, less than 1 inch possible. Tuesday night, mostly cloudy, low 32. Patchy freezing fog after 9 p.m. And mostly cloudy, high 38 on Wednesday. Currently 30 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business or nonprofit supports community radio. You can adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Leroy Bardis. Jim Roach assists with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.
Extinction Rebellion Palouse proudly supports KRFP. XR Palouse is organizing to have our governments and institutions declare a climate emergency, achieve climate justice and biodiversity, and leverage the power of arts and humanities to foster social change. CAREFP is dedicated to progressive values, including justice and multiculturalism.